Hello and welcome back to the podcast. This is Greg Kelly, the Greg Kelly Podcast. I am in a very, very, very small room in Florida. Oh, by the way, doesn't matter. It's fine. I just had a conversation with a man named James Zumwalt, a former EOD officer in the United States Navy, Explosive Ordnance Disposal. These guys go out and find mines, bombs, defuse them, blow them up. Have you ever seen the, well, we talk about the Hurt Locker. That's not very accurate, but it does come to mind when you talk to this gentleman. More recently, he just got back from Ukraine, where he was rescuing orphans. Huh? Really doesn't get more heroic than that, I guess, right? Going to a war zone and trying to save children. That's pretty beautiful. James Zumwalt, Z-U-M-W-A-L-T, happens to be the grandson of Admiral Elmo R. Zumwalt Jr., Elmo Zumwalt. He was probably one of the very most famous U.S. Navy admirals of all time. Who's another admiral other than him? Nimitz, maybe? Zumwalt is a huge, huge name in the military. His father also served, and his uncle famously served as well. And Maya Zumwalt is his cousin, and she produces this podcast. Executive produces so much of what's happening in the intrepid content media world. Many, many thanks. But I really enjoyed talking to this guy. He's very interesting. He's working with an amazing organization, the Aerial Recovery Group. Have you ever heard of that? What a great name, the Aerial Recovery Group. They do high-risk extractions, rescue people who are in danger in parts all over the world, like right after a horrible earthquake or a hurricane or, yes, a war. These guys come in and take out the most vulnerable, take out as in remove, help rescue, evacuate the most vulnerable people. If you would like, well, we'll talk about it. I think you're going to possibly want to donate to Ukraine Orphan Rescue after what you hear, what he has to say. So my conversation with James Zumwalt. So when were you last in Ukraine?
So I got back on, I don't know what the date was, but I got back on Saturday. So about a week now. And I was there for about 2.5, almost 3 weeks.
And what did you think? What was it like?
So here's the most, I guess I'll start at the beginning. When we landed in Poland, and we were planning on crossing the border, which would have been at that point about 4 or 5 days after, you know, the invasion. And we were anticipating once across the border to find ourselves in a war zone. It's not that. I mean, there is a war there. It's in the, you know, easternmost 15% of the country, east of Kyiv. But when we crossed in the west, in Lviv and, you know, the surrounding areas, actually, even in Kyiv, there were people holding hands, drinking lattes and eating in restaurants. So we were pretty shocked by that. They did have air raid sirens. So it kind of just, when I was there, reminded me of what I'm sure Israelis are used to, where you got air raid sirens and then you're going out to eat later. So, excuse me. So that was the biggest shock for us. And honestly, one of the strengths of aerial recovery, you know, especially with our background as special operators, is the agility of plan, agility of thought, because on our way over there, we were planning on just getting these kids across any border. And before we even had our boots on the ground, and especially once we saw that Ukraine is not a failed state yet, and also with the added intelligence that these human traffickers were just waiting to scoop them up at the respective borders, we pivoted before we even started and said, okay, let's maintain Ukrainian government control of these children, get them from the dangerous areas in the east, safely transport them to the West. And the key part was maintaining that Ukrainian jurisdiction over the kids.
Well, all right. Number one, how long have you been with the Aerial Recovery Group?
I've been with them for about a year now. It's a pretty new organization.
What is it?
For lack of a better way to define it, it's an NGO. It's a non-governmental organization with the focus on high-risk extraction. So I think their first, and I wasn't with them for this one, but their first real big mission was the earthquake in Haiti. And they were sweeping areas that USAID had deemed cleared. And I think their final tally in that first 2 or 3 days was they found 37 people with, you know, broken femurs, other major injuries that would have just left them to die in the elements. But this is the type of thing that Aerial Recovery focuses on, is high-risk extraction of the most vulnerable during a disaster. So, whether it's man-made or natural.
Now, high-risk extraction of human beings, high-risk in terms of the environment, high-risk in terms of the people themselves, somehow they're more vulnerable, or both?
Yeah, both. It could be after a major hurricane. It could be after an earthquake. This is the first situation we found ourselves in a war zone. So high risk in the sense of we're nimble and our skill set with our backgrounds in special operations is robust enough that we can get into some of these areas that the local governments either don't have the time or resources or training to get to. We focus on the most vulnerable. So I would say, you know, our primary goal is any orphanages in these areas because of the threat for human trafficking. Human traffickers really thrive in a disaster area where oversight is lacking, for lack of a better term. But it's not just limited to orphans. You know, if there's a elderly or, you know, any kind of handicap, mental or physical, that prevents them from, you know, maneuverability, that's where we would like to focus our efforts.
Where do you get okay, so it's an amazing mission. It sounds like it's really necessary. Who came up with this, and how long has it been? You say just a year. Whose brainchild is this?
So it's I've been with them for a year. I want to say they initially started up, and don't hold me to this. I probably should know this off the top of my head, but I want to say like 2017 timeframe, and it's the brainchild of, it's a very small organization. There's only 4 full-time employees. And at the top is our CEO, who's Brittany Turner. I don't know if she goes by Locke now, because she recently got married to our chief operating officer, Jeremy Locke. And, you know, I don't know how to describe these two. You know, you could say powerhouse, but it's powerhouse for good. If you could have a powerhouse couple dedicated to, you know, making the world a better place, it would be these two. And they're the ones that kind of saw the need and wanted to help. Because I know that Brittany has her origins in the Caribbean and saw after hurricanes and these earthquakes the need for such a thing.
So, all right. Amazing. How many kids did you get out of there?
To date, we're at 523. Now, I want to say our ability to get more, to save more and more of these children is going to be exponential, because when we first landed on the ground, there were about 5 of us. We didn't even have a van, so we had to, you know, day one, find a van. And then while we're running these high-risk extractions, we're also at the same time trying to establish a relationship with the Ukrainian government. We're trying to establish rat lines for supplies in and out of Poland. And also, not to mention, we work with this other NGO called New Horizons for Children that's quarterbacked by a lady. We call her Mama Bear, but her name is Sherry McClurg out of Ohio. And they focus. They're essentially clinical psychologists who focus on childhood trauma. And so once we get them to a safe place, we hand them over to these professionals for the aftercare.
Okay. But can I ask you this? So you're working with the Ukrainian government, or you try to establish a relationship with them. Does anybody have to invite you to begin with, or is this on the group's own initiative? I mean, how did you get this idea? I mean, was it an assignment? How would you describe it?
Yeah, so, and you know what? As far as the initial legalities, I would probably, I don't want to step on Brittany Turner's toes. I'm sure there might have been some kind of paperwork that we had to draft up before we got there. But what I can speak on is the memorandum of understanding we were able to get signed with the Ukrainian government, which outlines, you know, it's essentially a contract which outlines our roles and responsibilities, left and right parameters. And it basically legally defines this mission that we want to do, the high risk evacuation and extraction. And it provides us some freedom of maneuverability because there's so many checkpoints, there's curfews in play. And this way we have the proper documentation that we can actually work and get the job done.
All right. So the job, like, I mean, I'm guessing there are only so many orphanages in Ukraine. You mentioned that life is kind of going on as normal to some degree. Mm-hmm. What put these orphans necessarily at risk? I know there's a war going on that would seem kind of automatic, but how are they at risk?
No, and that's a great question. So what I would say is from a war standpoint, what we see in the mainstream media is about 15% accurate, 15, right? So there is a war on, you know, I wouldn't say it's an invasion per se. It's hard to describe that, which is a different conversation, but there's 15% of the East, of the regions in the East that are at war. Yeah, he's reaching out and touching some areas, some military targets in the West near Lviv. So that part is 15% accurate. However, what's absolutely real is the refugee crisis. So, you know, Ukrainian population is about 40 million roughly. They have 200,000 orphans, which, you know, without going into too much math and boring everybody, basically we have, the United States has twice as many orphans with about six times the population, or eight times, I'm sorry, the population. So per capita, there are a lot of orphans in Ukraine. Why? I don't know. But what's happening now is the fear is real, even though the war is only about 15% accurate. And I think about 4 million people have already evacuated Ukraine, which is 10% of the population. And what's happened is there's about roughly from the Ukrainian government, they're saying about 5,000 orphans who are, quote unquote, at risk, meaning unaccounted for. We don't know where they are. And we're trying to make sure that, you know, you could tell I've been hanging out with my 2-year-old and my 4-year-old because I'm going to use a pretty bad analogy, but it's almost like a hungry hippo's effort. We're trying to grab, you know, get as many kids under the jurisdiction of the Ukrainian government, keep them accounted for and safe, move them to the West before these traffickers can get in there. And really, you know, not to sound too hyperbolic, but create a fate worse than death, in my opinion, for these kids.
Wait, who's trying to create a fate worse than death?
It is these traffickers.
These traffickers,
They take advantage of the chaos, and it doesn't have to be a war. You know, it could be an earthquake, it could be a hurricane, what have you. But you know, doing this research and being in this line of work has changed my entire paradigm. So when I hear of some kind of calamity going on in the world, my first thought is, okay, there's kids that are getting exploited right now, and we got to go protect them.
All right. Well, number one, the kids that we're talking about, orphans, like what age range are we dealing with here?
I would say about 3 to 14.
And, okay, we don't know why there are so many orphans in Ukraine to begin with. They're just an unusually large number. Are they generally kept in orphanages, or what? How would you describe their facilities?
Yeah, so their facilities are lacking. They're all the orphanages in Ukraine are government run. There's a lot of well-intentioned people working in the Ukrainian government, but that orphan problem is so big for them. The facilities are lacking. I don't know how else to explain it other than that. And so that's one of the things that is important for us is we don't want to just save the lives of these kids, but there's, you know, moral responsibility when we actually get them from the East, transport them safely to the West. We don't want to just stop there and high five ourselves and say, hey, job well done. You know, we want to improve the lives of these kids instead of just saving them. So that's where your aftercare comes in. And I think this is a good opportunity without kind of getting too far ahead of myself and our mission over there, but this is going to be a good opportunity to have some high level government advisors, perhaps from the outside, if Ukraine is open to that, to come in and help Ukraine improve this system from government run orphanages to the foster care system, which isn't great, but it's better than these government run orphanages.
So were these orphans like leaving the orphanages on their own and making their way to the border with Poland, or, you know, or were they waiting to be extracted from the actual facilities?
Right.
Describe
it's all of, yeah, it's all of the above. We streamlined our process because as you can imagine, the requests that we are receiving, are numerous and they're everywhere. And they range in severity and panic. You know, some of them are like, hey, if you can swing by, that's great. Others are, you know, we've been in this bunker for a week now getting shelled. We need help right now. There was one, I know that Jeremy mentioned it a couple of days ago. So I feel like I can mention that here, but, you know, we got a bus of kids out, and then the fighting was so bad, we had to get them back into the shelter and wait another couple of days until we can get them out safely again. So they're asking, you know, they're sending us, SOSs, and we have a streamlined process now, where we can make sure that there's good points of contact, there's good coordinates, you know, all the due diligence to make sure that, we can actually get these kids out safe and get our team in safely.
Would you call any of these kids, like, I guess it wasn't fit. Are they runaways ever? Are they kind of like leaving on their own? Are they like in the bunker? Did they have adults with them or are they on their own?
Yeah. And I see what you're saying.
Yeah. And what about like, were they technically, you know, were they fleeing to the border on their own? Were there adults around?
It's so chaotic, Greg, that, all of the above are right. So, for the most part, for the most part, there is a caretaker with them, and that is our point of contact. And that can be an orphanage worker. That's usually the case, actually. It's usually an orphanage worker. We have heard of some of the kids, you know, leaving on their own. There's reports, I know that the EU had mentioned this, of human traffickers wearing yellow vests and coming into the orphanages and saying they're a group like us, right? I mean, they're just saying that we're here to help. And then, you know, they jump in line with the human traffickers. So, you know, it's a mess. It's a total mess. But, you know, we're making progress through the chaos, really to just, you know, save as many of these kids as we can.
The traffickers. Now, you say that, I think you know through your experience, there's a calamity, the traffickers show up, right?
Yep.
So are the traffickers that are now running around Ukraine, are they from other countries? Are they Ukrainians? I mean, is this a target of opportunity for them? Well, it is, I guess. Just to describe who these traffickers are and, you know, are they waiting for something to happen where they can swoop in and do this kind of stuff?
So the sad fact is, Greg, like, and, you know, one of the things I would like to press most, you know, if there's anything to take away for your audience is this human trafficking problem is huge. I mean, it's exponentially larger than I thought it was before I started looking into it. It's the fastest growing black market industry. They say on a GDP perspective, it's right behind guns and drugs. I think that's just what they can measure. I think if you take in the stuff that the authorities don't know about, it's very possibly the largest black market industry. So these, it's always going on even before the war. They just, as you said, it's really a great target of opportunity because the going rate is, you know, I'm pulling it from my memory from 2 years ago, but I want to say it's about, you know, $3,000 to $5,000 a head for a child, which is free money for them. They pick, you know, they swoop in, take advantage of lack of oversight in these disaster areas. And we're just, you know, we're just a small group, but we're just trying to stop that from happening.
So $3,000, $3,000 to $5,000. I mean, who's paying it? And then what happens to the child? What are we talking about? Like, where, what is it? What happens?
It's a large percentage of it is for the sex industry. A large percentage of it is labor. And that is, that's essentially where these kids are ending up. It's, you know, as a father myself, and most of these guys in Ariel are fathers themselves, it's, you know, it's just hard not to picture the faces of your own kids in these bunkers, in the bus windows, you know, just kind of confused. And that's, we try to clear up that confusion. So anyway, it's a bad situation for these kids to be in, to put it mildly. And usually what ends up happening is once they're in that black market, it's very difficult to track them down, you know, because they won't stay in the same area. They'll get them across, you know, another border. But it's so hard to track down a specific child once they're in the clutches of, you know, for lack of a better term, they're just evil people.
So is there a black market for adopted children? I mean, are there, like, you know, we want to sell these kids into adopted families? Is that part of it?
I, you know what? I don't want to speak on that because I don't know.
Okay. No, skip that. Then the labor part. Now, like, where, what countries would Ukrainian, let's say you couldn't save all the kids, and, you know, where are these Ukrainian children entering into the black labor market?
It's all over the world, really. You know, so I think the worst for the labor is down in Africa and Eastern Europe. On the sex industry side of the house, it's, you know, nauseating to say, but the biggest demand is here in the U.S. And so that's, you know, I think it's gaining some traction. People are kind of starting to wake up to the fact that the worst, for lack of a better term, holiday for sex trafficking is on the Super Bowl. And that's because the supply is here in the West. It's in Europe, but especially here in the United States. That's where the demand is. And the supply is pretty much everywhere, all over the world.
The demand is in the United States for...
The demand, yeah. The U.S. has the highest demand for that black market, not just children, but also women, sex industry. It's, you know, it's kind of gross to talk about.
No, look, I mean,
the reality
it is, and we should talk about it. And the thing that, but that is in a way, like, incredible to me. There is a thriving demand for children for sex in America.
Yes.
Where does that happen, and how is that? I mean, I'm kind of in shock. I mean, I thought you were going to say, you know, Southeast Asia or something like that. I mean, how does that work? Who are these, or what are they doing? Like, how would an American go about doing this? And we can talk about how can they avoid not being caught. I mean, can you just break it down a little bit further?
Yeah. So it's not like they can, just jump on Google. You know what I mean? They have their ways around on the dark web and, you know, all these types of things. They have their code words. You know, they're constantly avoiding, you know, the authorities. But there is this market, and it's kind of where you are right now, where you're kind of in shock about it. That's where I was, and looking for something to do about it. And, you know, really by the grace of God came into Aerial Recovery. But, you know, there's a dark web for this, you know, even darker industry. And where there's a will, there's a way. And the disposable income is so much higher in the West, you know, in the US and in Europe. It just kind of makes sense. That's where the supply would flow to.
Now, why is it? Now, number one, I would just take it that you work or you make referrals to law enforcement, correct?
So right now, Aerial Recovery's mission, we don't necessarily touch on that, but what we do is we're just trying to keep them out of the hands of these traffickers.
I understand. You're right. That's a little bit further down.
Yeah. So we just want to make sure that, you know, think of it as a preventative effort, what we're doing right now and what Aerial has always done. It's always preventative. But this just happens to be my awareness of how bad the situation is in the world.
And so I heard that, by the way, there are a lot of these children making it to the border. They're unaccompanied. The border in particular is where there's a real vulnerability to be taken in by traffickers.
Yeah, that's right. And so because the way it works in that part of the world, if you have an unaccompanied child that crosses the border, that child is now a ward of that country. And so it takes a long process for them to get back into Ukraine as a Ukrainian citizen. It's, I think, don't hold me to this, but it's, you know, a year or two once they cross that border to get back. So, you know, you can imagine that kind of confusion and chaos is what we're trying to avoid, which is why, you know, Aerial Recovery decided, okay, we're going to get them out of the danger areas into the West, keep them under the jurisdiction of the Ukrainian government. You know, just to avoid those very severe pitfalls.
This is amazing.
At the border.
All right. Hey, where are you from originally?
So I was born and raised in the DC area, Northern Virginia, and was a product of the Catholic education system where, you know, we couldn't get away with anything, but we kept trying to. So.
And your grandfather, your name is James Zumwalt. Your grandfather is the world-famous late, great Elmo Zumwalt, Admiral Elmo Zumwalt. He was the chief of naval operations, correct?
Yeah, that's him. And, you know, unfortunately, I got his eyebrows. He had these giant eyebrows. And the Zumwalt family's not very creative. There's four Jameses and four Elmos. And I don't think Katie would have agreed to the first date if my name was Elmo.
What was your grandfather like?
So he died when I was 18. He was, I'll put it to you this way. They did a great job of keeping me insulated. I thought the world was just a small world because people kept asking me after they heard the last name, they'd say, was your grandfather an admiral? And I'm like, yeah, my grandpa was an admiral in the Navy. That's weird. You know, telemarketers, everyone would ask that. And, he was, your fun loving grandpa. Like, he was a prankster. He loved giving my dad a hard time and I loved just watching it. And I didn't necessarily think anything was abnormal until, it was after he died. I went to, Tulane NROTC down in New Orleans and I realized, okay, yeah, grandpa's not, there's something different about this guy. So it was eye opening.
You went to Tulane. What'd you major in?
International relations.
And ROTC, we know what that is. And you graduate in what year?
That was 2005.
And you were commissioned an ensign in the Navy?
Yes.
What did you do first?
So, you know, speaking of my grandpa, everyone thought I joined the Navy because of him and because of the family name, which, you know, isn't, it's not exactly true. Like, Top Gun was the greatest recruiting tool the Navy has ever had. So I actually signed on because I saw Top Gun too many times. I'm like, you know, I'll fly jets, ride motorcycles. And so when I was a senior at Tulane, I already had my spot reserved in flight school. But there was a guy that came through just to visit the unit, and he was a Navy EOD tech, explosive ordnance disposal, the bomb squad. And he even said, I'm here just to talk to you guys so that the Navy would pay for me and my wife to come here. And I just thought he was everything he was describing. That's when the IED was, you know, killing so many of our people, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he was talking about jumping out of airplanes, helicopters, diving, shooting. And mainly with the mission of saving lives. So I relinquished my spot in flight school and hustled to, and luckily got in, but to become a Navy EOD tech.
EOD, again, you said it, explosive ordnance disposal, right?
Yes.
And in the Navy, when I think EOD, I think mines, you know, mines that are put on the side of ships. I mean, that's probably wrong, but what traditionally in the Navy, can you describe what EOD is?
Absolutely, yeah. So what you describe in on the underwater portion is the Navy EOD bread and butter mission set. So we go to dive school first. You know, you really learn a lot about yourself there. A lot of grumpy instructors. That underwater portion is paramount for Navy EOD. But during my time frame, my generation of EOD tech, so much of it was land based. So you're taking care of everything from, you know, your chemical, biological, radiological devices down to your smallest IED and hand grenades. So they train you up on how to render those things safe. And then you'll be embedded as a Navy EOD tech, either with the Marines, you know, on a SEAL team, or with the Army Special Forces guys.
This sounds a bit like the movie The Hurt Locker. Is that
right? Yeah. I didn't see that until years and years after it came out. I finally like caved and watched it. But the only thing I'd say about that movie is the two things that were accurate. We never used the bomb suit because it was too hot. You couldn't think anyway. And the IEDs were so big there, it wasn't going to save you. So that part was true. And then the other part that they nailed was at the end, after his deployment, he's walking through the grocery store with his wife, driving her nuts. And she said, just go pick out some cereal. And there's a scene where he's just standing in the cereal aisle. He doesn't know what to do. So after the black and white decisions, when you start coming back home to that gray of every day, it makes it a little more difficult for decision making. So that part rung true for me.
Dude, I hear you loud and clear. That scene, that was so poignant, so powerful. There are two things I remember. Number one, him walking in the suit at the end of the movie and how like kind of happy he was to be back.
Yep.
And that moment in the grocery store, which was just, it was perfect. And
yep.
I don't think you even need to necessarily have been to combat to appreciate it. But it helps certainly, but it was just amazing the choices, the excess we have in America and how it can be paralyzing at times, especially if you lived in a different manner. I'll put it this
right
way. So,
right.
Wow. All right. Fascinating. Now let's go back to, so you, how long does it take to get trained up to do all this stuff?
For Navy EOD or for aerial?
Well, did you do both?
Yeah. So I guess, you know, with aerial, it's kind of organic to your previous special operations career anyway. But so for Navy EOD, it was 6 to 8 months for dive school, which was pretty physically intensive, a high attrition rate there.
Wait, is this SEAL training?
It's where they're beating you up underwater. You know, they get you proficient in scuba and then the rebreathers, the Mark 16s. So, really I think they used to call it water relaxation techniques, which is oxymoronic because they're basically, they're beating you up at the bottom of a 20-foot pool.
So, where was this? Where did this training go down?
That was in Panama City, in Florida.
Okay.
The naval diving, NDSTC, naval diving training, Navy Diving Salvage Training Center.
And what is aerial training? What is the aerial training?
Well, with aerial, it's really not too intensive. They kind of, most of their vetting is done with your, you know, DD-214. So, we're still such a small group. They can figure out pretty quickly if you're bona fide or not. And so what we really want to place an emphasis on is, you know, that medical background, because yeah, I'm a Navy EOD tech, but I've also had, you know, a lot of the medical training that comes as a result, your tactical combat casualty care, et cetera. We have a lot of PJs. Those guys are worth their weight in gold. You know, Air Force pararescue men. And that's the capability we want to bring to these disaster areas, is that field medicine capability.
Right. All right. But back to your naval training. So after you go through the underwater, what was your first assignment, your first unit?
So I was part of the last officer, Navy EOD officer training pipeline, where they still sent you out into the fleet for a year and a half. I went kicking and screaming because there was a war on, and you know, I was eager to get there. But they sent me out to Hawaii on a rescue and salvage boat ship. Sorry, sir. Like my CO, if he listens, he's going to really cringe at that one. So I was on there on the USS Salvor. We dove on the USS Legardo, which was a submarine, a World War II submarine that we found in the Gulf of Thailand. And we dove on that at about, I think it was 240 feet to identify it. Came back from there when I was done with my time on the Salvor, was able to get to Navy EOD training in Eglin, Florida. And that's essentially your bomb school. And that's about a year and change. I'd say maybe 15 to 16 months.
Damn, that's a lot. Wait, when you're jumping off that boat, as you put it, the ship, and looking at that submarine, what was that all about? You were salvaging the submarine, is that it?
Well, they these fishermen, I guess, got their nets caught up and called it in while we were on deployment. And since we were in the area, we got deployed over there to get some divers on it, hard hat divers. And we had to identify it, you know, properly and officially. So I want to say that job was about 2 weeks diving on that. And then, you know, finally got the proper identification, put a plaque on it, held a ceremony for, you know, the sailors on the USS Legardo, and then continued on after that.
How do you like being underwater? How did you like being underwater? I mean,
I still do it, actually. In the springtime, I work with an environmental company, and we clear out old bombing ranges, you know, ordnance items in shallow water, like 90 feet and up. So it's, especially with the rebreathers, I'm actually more comfortable underwater than I am on land.
I'm sorry, what do you call them?
Oh, sorry about that. Rebreathers. So it's Mark 16s, and they recycle your air loop, so there's no bubbles underwater.
And is it like in the movie, I forgot what movie it was, but you can talk, your entire face is like covered, and you can just breathe normally in a way, right?
Kind of, but this one has, yeah, it's similar to that, but it has hoses. It has a one-way hose going out on the right. It gets scrubbed, oxygen gets added to it in the backpack, and then when you breathe in, it comes in from the left. So you have tubes. If you're looking at it, it looks like there's two tubes coming into your face mask. It's slightly different than the one that people are used to seeing, which is the Mark 21, the full face.
So what's the deepest you've ever been?
I can't remember. I want to say it was about 220, 240 in that time. In that we were using TriMix, which, you know, when you're topside and you're listening to the guys talking, it sounds like Alvin and the Chipmunks, but which is kind of hard to act tough when that's happening. Uh-huh. But yeah, that was the deepest I've ever been.
And what about the cold water? Does that bother you?
It's miserable. Yeah. Now that I'm out, with this environmental company, I, I really only dive clear, warm water anymore unless national security is at risk. I'm not going to. Yeah, cold water is pretty miserable.
All right. So you're kind of just not killing time, but you're anxious to get to the war. You go through the bomb school. What happens next?
So once you finish there, we go out to tactical training out in San Diego, and that's where you're doing your – you get your static line, think, you know, 101st Airborne stuff, and then you're getting your Hurst cast basically come in and out of helicopters into the water, that type of stuff. You're shooting, and then they take you out to the teams. That's really where your – training really begins. And one of the things that's best about Navy EOD is it's still pretty much run by the non-commissioned officers, you know, the guys with all the experience. So once we got there, you're really learning how to be an EOD tech. So I was in Virginia Beach for my whole career at Mobile Unit 2, trained up on a whirlwind. Training was actually harder than deployment, which I think is how it should be. And then my first deployment, we were out in Al-Anbar province on the back end of the surge, attached with the Marines. And that's in that capacity, we were essentially just think of it like firefighters. You're waiting for a call. Someone thinks they see an IED and you go respond to it. So we were busy doing that. And then when I finished that deployment, got picked up for a Special Operations Force, 4-man Navy EOD team. And we were attached with the Army Special Forces guys, the 5th Group up, excuse me, at Fort Campbell. So that was enjoyable because the training was exponentially more in depth. And the mission set was great, and we finally got to be the cat instead of the mouse.
When you're learning how to do this stuff, by the way, I mean, this is basically in a layman's, you know, this is the bomb squad. This is finding a bomb and defusing it, ordnance disposal, or is it taking a live bomb and disposing of it, burying it or putting it far away, or is it both?
So in my first deployment, if life or property is threatened, if life or property is not threatened, then we can use the robots, which happened, I'd say, about 70% of the time. If life or property or like a main supply route is threatened, then you got to go hands on where you're cutting wires on it. So in that capacity, ideally, you want to just put some, you know, C4 on it and make it go away, but you don't always get to do that. In the second deployment, it was a lot more you're working with what you have on your back, and in a, you know, special operations offensive capability. So you're looking for tripwires, booby traps, you know, houses that they clearly don't want us to go into because they spiderweb booby trap the whole thing. So, so in that regard, you make it go away when you can, but if you have to, you just cut wires on it.
So number one, when you mentioned putting C4 on it and making it go away, that's like a plastique. You basically put a bomb on the bomb,
yep,
blow it up, and it takes care of everything, right?
Yeah. You're basically blowing it up on your terms.
The other thing is, you say the robot, and when life and property are not at risk, and I guess you have the advantage of time, you send in the robot. But it's not really a robot. I mean, it's a remote-controlled apparatus that you guys – it's like more like a drone in a way, like a land drone.
That's right.
Yeah. And you move arms on it to do what you need to do?
Yeah, you can actually cut wires with, you know, the robots that we use. You can or you could just place C4 on it again, you know, and make that go away. But the it's obviously a little more difficult because you're looking through a screen and using, you know, a joystick instead of your own hands. But I don't know what made me think of this, but the just as a random tidbit, the emotional attachment that these EOD techs have with their robot is beyond a pet. It is interesting. It's almost like there's a personification of that robot, and you develop an emotional attachment with it, which is pretty silly to think about.
Cutting wires. Man, like, I would imagine that there are, you know, a trillion variations to how a bad guy can configure it all. And
yes,
to go in there and decode that sounds like it would be obviously very dangerous and then also very hard.
Yeah, and they, I'll tell you what, the training is so good. The U.S., and I can't necessarily speak for the other branches, but the U.S. Navy, I'm sure they're fantastic too, but the U.S. Navy EOD training is so good. So they teach us, you know, the rule number one of IEDs is the construction of an IED is up to the imagination of the bomb maker. So it's endless. It's limitless. They can come up with anything, and you can't, it's not like you can just go in and memorize, you know, how you make an IED, like you can, you know, a grenade or a cruise missile. So the way Navy EOD trains us is how to think like a bomb maker, and they give you behaviors. And if you see this, what are you going to do? You know, that kind of thing. And they essentially are putting your mind in the mindset of the bomb maker, which to me is seems like a pretty obvious way to go about it, but it accounts for every single possible scenario you can come across.
Wow. That's that does sound like state-of-the-art training. I mean, that just that's really incredible. That's impressive. That's just that's next level stuff. When you think back to your time in Iraq, and how many deployments?
I did two total.
Was there one particular mission moment where you had to defuse a bomb? You actually had to cut wires, or what? Or another scenario? What was like the most challenging, diciest? If you had to tell a war story, what comes to mind?
The sad thing is, Greg, the first five that came up are like classified, but maybe I can work around that. There was one in particular, the one that still is pretty amazing. We were driving, it's more of like a human connection as opposed to an operational, scary war story, but we were driving and it was near a bazaar that should have been crowded at that point in time, and it wasn't. And I remember looking through and I saw this lady in a burqa where you could only see her eyes. And she looked at me right through the window and just like ominously shook her head. And I just remember being like, okay, that's something to pay attention to. And so I just told the whole unit, like, hey, I'll stop. Like, let's go in reverse and not go this way. Sure enough, you know, we were able to get to the job we needed to get to, reported that up to higher. And they asked me, you know, what tells you that this is a bad area? I'm like, I couldn't just say because this lady shook her head at me. So I kind of just essentially lied and said, oh, I have really good intel and, you know, made something up. And turns out, because we didn't have the time to take care of the problem then, another EOD team took care of it. And it was most of the convoy would have been gone. Everyone was fine. But just because some lady shook her head at me, you know, I'd say maybe 28 of us are still around. So it just kind of, for me, that stands out because she didn't have to do that, you know, and I'm never going to see her. And but she kind of had pity on us, and thank God she did.
It's amazing. Wow. So look, you're enjoying this though, right? You enjoyed the work?
I do. And the one thing I would say, especially as a guy that's living on borrowed time anyway, what I would say to your audience is this, like just keep doing things that make you find yourself surrounded by people better than you. So when I was, you know, in Navy EOD, I'm looking around just totally humbled, like surrounded by these heroes. And now here with Ariel, you have some of the highest trained elite guys that the U.S. has to offer on their own time saying, you know, we care enough about the most vulnerable of our human society that we're going to put our lives on the line to make sure that they're safe and use our talent. And there's zero. And Greg, what I can't stress enough is like, there's not just as an organization from Brittany Turner and Jeremy Locke on down, but to a man, to a person, there's zero ego, and it's extremely refreshing to be around. Our first 5 days, looking back, I've realized this, our first 5 days in Ukraine, we pulled 2 all-nighters and 3 nights we slept 2 hours each. And, you know, I was sleeping on a folded cardboard box underneath the stairwell because Marco took the couch. I hope you hear that, Marco. But the thing is, these guys woke up happy. They woke up with joy in their heart, ready to get to work, even though we were hungry and tired and exhausted. Because I think there's something that's even better than happiness, and that's this inner peace that comes from applying what you have to offer to service to others.
So when did you get out of the military?
I got out, when was that? 2010.
So 5 years active duty?
Yeah, 5 and some change.
Why did you leave?
So it's funny. I would have stayed in if I could have stayed operational. So, and if there's any Navy EOD leadership out there listening to this, please pay attention. This is where you pay attention. So the problem I had was I wanted to stay operational. And you probably remember this, Greg, from your time in, but professional development is paramount for these guys. So I, you know, even that they said, what would you like to do now? And I'd say, I'd like to take the same team out, same mission. And they said that I would have to become operations officer. It's a promotion. Like, I should be glad about that. But meanwhile, there was another lieutenant who didn't want to deploy anymore, who wanted to be operations officer. And I was like, how about you guys just switch us? And they didn't end up doing that. I even wrote a paper referencing the chaotic billeting model from World War II, told them, you know, it cost you guys $2.3 million a piece to train me and this other guy up. I was using all the arguments. I even tried renouncing my commission so I can come back in as like an E5. Anyway, I used all the tricks, but long and short of it, I got out because I didn't want to like sit behind a desk and wave the boys off. So I got out and started wave the boys off.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, the guys.
And you got out and you started working as a what?
I started working as a counter IED analyst at the Pentagon as a contractor.
So. Wow. So the bureaucracy won. The bureaucracy would not bend.
Yeah, it wouldn't bend. And, you know, I was trying to explain to them, we had lieutenant colonels as platoon commanders in World War II because all they wanted to do is just keep deploying. But, you know, that was falling on deaf ears. So if I could have, just kept deploying, rank didn't matter to me. I just love the work because there's something about removing death from the battlefield that's a pretty powerful feeling.
So it was a little bit, I mean, the Hurt Locker in a weird way, because that guy really wanted back on the battlefield. I mean, is it a little bit reminiscent in, I guess, American Sniper? I mean, putting apart or stepping away from the whole trauma side of all this, they just really wanted to be back in the fight. And that was you as well?
That was me. And I would say for me, it was less, I mean, the adrenaline aspect of it is certainly there, but that's like sixth or seventh as far as motivation. Cause for me, it was the mission and the guys. I didn't trust my guys with any other officer. So I was like, I just wanted to keep deploying with them. But, you know, that aside, the mission itself, it's such a unique, it's a unique thing to be in a war zone and remove death.
Yeah, it's unique, and it's pure.
Exactly.
And you, very few people have that skill.
Yeah, and it's you have the skill that the government, the military, Navy trained you up. You're good at it. And it's kind of like a military working dog. It's like, let me just keep doing what I'm good at and save more lives. But, you know, it just wasn't in the cards. So, you know, you kind of move on and then figure out the civilian aspect of your life, which, as you know, is pretty interesting. It's a process in and of itself.
But you did not really branch out. I mean, you went into the same line of work, essentially, but as a civilian. I mean, the closest you can get to what you were doing in the military, it seems like, kind of, as a civilian.
That's exactly right. Yeah, exactly. And you know, I went from the Navy EOD teams, where trust is just implicit, to the Pentagon, where, you know, you could trust about 75% of those guys. And then, like an idiot, I went to the Capitol Hill, where I'm like, I think I could trust three people here.
Well, wait, two couple things. The there was a new type of IED, the Iranian, I forgot what it was called. It's like an
IED. The EFP?
The what?
Explosively formed projectile,
yes.
The EFP.
Yes.
Yeah, I actually, one of them, I actually cleaned it up, the copper bowl part, and it's my jewelry bowl by my front door right now. Probably shouldn't say that. But anyway, it was one that we diffused, and it's just a copper piece now. Oh. But those things were particularly deadly because it rendered our best armor useless. It could punch through anything.
Wow. And you can counter those on the battlefield, like you said.
Oh, yeah. They were there. They were everywhere. And definitely state-sponsored level construction.
Are you thinking along the way, at some point you had to think, okay, when I leave the military, this war is going to be over. You know, I'm going to have to do something else unrelated to warfare. But, you know, you're spending all your time worried about bombs. Did you worry about that?
You mean the transition to what?
Yeah, like what you would do afterwards, what you would do when this is all over.
That's exactly. Yeah. And that is hard. That's hard to emphasize to, you know, civilians, how weird that transition is. And I see it with some of my best friends that are still in, because I tell them, look, at some point you have to grow up. Like, Navy EOD in this war is not the entirety of this book of your life. It's an important chapter, but it's not the entire book. And so any veterans, you know, out there that are struggling with that, first of all, know you're not alone. But second of all, just know that, like, what we did, and yourself included, Greg, what we did was important. It was necessary, but it doesn't make up everything you are. And the sooner you come to terms with that, the happier your life is going to be. And the sooner you're actually going to find how to put yourself in the application of service to others anyway. And whether that's your family, your neighborhood, you know, your wife, your kids, whatever. Or orphans in Ukraine, you know, it's important for us veterans to just wrap our brains around the fact that that's a small part of our lives. It's not the entire partial.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you did at the Pentagon as a civilian analyst for this kind of stuff?
Yeah, no worries there. So technically, I was a counter IED analyst, and you know, there's an old military. Big military machine term called weapons intelligence. And a good way to describe it was weapons intelligence for this rapidly evolving IED threat. And, you know, some of it was reverse engineering some of the newer tactics, techniques, and procedures that the guys were finding, you know, and then trying to project what their next TTP might be, like predictive programming almost. And so that was, it was kind of rewarding, but, you know, I was wearing a suit, you know, I was still kind of coming to terms with the fact that, you know, I don't have wire cutters in an M4 anymore. But that was a good way for me to kind of, as you alluded to, have one foot in and one foot out.
So, by the way, were you married? Did you get married during any of this time?
No, during that time, I wasn't married. My wife, Katie, we knew each other in college down at Tulane. You know, I kept, even in college, I kept hitting on her and she kept saying no. But so we were friends for 12 years. But at this point, I was not married. And then it wasn't until 2014, end of 2013, that me and Katie started dating and, you know, got engaged shortly thereafter. But I always told myself I didn't want to. When I was in, I did not want to widow anybody. Right. So, you know, these guys on the special forces teams, on the SEAL teams, Navy EOD techs with kids, I do not know how they were able to do the job that they did and still do, you know, with a wife and kids at home. I was a little more cowardly than that. I couldn't do it.
What, all right. What was Capitol Hill like? Who did you work for?
So Capitol Hill, well, no, it's a family show. I can't exactly say what Capitol Hill is like, but I worked for Congressman Jeff Miller. He was chairman of Veterans Affairs Committee. And he was the congressman for Florida District 1, where I live now. Actually, we got the panhandle, but you know, we have such a high percentage of veterans in the area. It's a great place to live. That's why me and my wife, you know, decided to set up roots here, and we'll probably live the rest of our lives down here. But Capitol Hill is essentially what everyone knows it to be. It's a lot of talking. It's a lot of it's, for lack of a better word, it's, you know, not to be too aggressive, it's, you know, a lot of two-faced aspects to it. You know, people are saying one thing, doing another. The staff, this on both sides of the aisle, were fantastic people. You could actually have conversations left and right and learn from each other and respect each other. So that part of it was really cool. But as a whole, as an institution, we kind of need to just get everyone out and start afresh. And honestly, we need to change our paradigm about who we're electing. Like, you know, I say we place more focus on some of these blue collar Americans, to run for office. So that's my two cents.
You ran yourself, correct?
I did. Yeah. Don't hold that against me, Greg.
When did you run?
I ran in 2016. It was a crowded field against Matt Gaetz. And, you know, by the time we had just moved, my wife and I, we just moved down here and, you know, I was looking at some jobs, and I had one already nailed with the diving, but
wait, he wasn't in Congress yet, or was he? He was, you ran against him. He was running for an open seat or somebody was retiring.
Exactly.
Okay. Gotcha. All right.
Yeah. Jeff Miller had announced his retirement, leaving the seat open. And, you know, Matt had such a, and his family has such a strong name down here. It was really like a juggernaut to run against him. And, you know, honestly, he votes for the most part like how I'd want my congressman to vote anyway. So, you know, I'm cheering him on. But that was an experience. You know, running for Congress was totally miserable. You know, I enjoyed meeting the people. My motivation for running was, it was a, you know, the machine, charging the machine gun nest analogy. I knew that was the next front line for the country. I do think that veteran representation needs to increase, on both sides of the aisle. But you know, losing that election was just a blessing in disguise because, yeah, nothing against Matt. It's just kind of the nature of the beast. My buddies and I did in Ukraine for a week, has more impact than I think anything I could do in Congress for 15 years.
Now that's amazing. That really is awesome. And it's wonderful that you have that perspective and awareness now. And like, I totally believe it. Totally resonates. I mean, absolutely. Good for you.
Yeah. And it's, well, thanks for saying that. And, you know, it's, I have a simpler mind. I mean, I, for me, there's something about tangible work that you can actually see the impact, at the end of it that, is so rewarding. And that's not why we're doing it. We're so mission focused. We just want to keep, we want to save more kids, and as many as we can. But at the same time, you know, it's, seeing the fruits, the smiles on these kids' faces when they can actually point to a bed and say, that's mine. I'm not hearing air raid sirens. I'm safe now. You know, it's an unprecedented feeling, and I don't see anything in DC or Capitol Hill coming close to that.
You say the work is seasonal. How does that, play out? What does that look like?
Oh, for employment now?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I'm contractor with Aerial Recovery Group, and that's kind of as needed. And I do the, unexploded ordnance diving, once a month, or I'm sorry, 1 month out of the year in the springtime. But, and Greg, I kid you not, after the career I've had, this is my main job title is what you, when people ask you at a cocktail party, what do? My answer now is just, it's the fastest conversation ender. 'Cause I'm an insurance adjuster. And people, when you tell people you're an insurance adjuster, they're like looking for hors d'oeuvres that aren't there. They're like, oh, that's neat. Anyway, I got to go over here now. So, so that's the seasonal aspect of it where, you know, after a hurricane or something, I'll work for maybe a month or two and then work for a month in the springtime diving. But it's a beautiful setup because it just buys me more time at home with, you know, Katie and the boys, and to donate my time, you know, to aerial recovery, like in the Ukraine.
Amazing. An interesting observation. I would personally have a lot of questions for an insurance adjuster. I mean, I don't even know what the hell that is, to be honest. You're the guy, you show up and you see a broken down, damaged, edifice, and you're like, that costs $10,000, right?
Yep. Yeah. So you, you inspect these houses after a hurricane, a tornado, a fire, what have you. And you know, you're inspecting the roof on down, and applying a, you write an estimate for that. And it really is honestly a way to help people. Honestly, it's a good way to help homeowners because, these insurance companies, can be difficult to work with sometimes, but a picture is worth a thousand words, and I'm kind of speaking in code so I don't get myself in trouble. But there's ways you can protect, not, you know, you're a third party that's unbiased, but, you're able to protect homeowners and actually the insurance companies from anything crazy going on.
Wait, you're a third party. Who do you work for?
So you, I get paid by the insurance companies, but I'm an independent. So basically, how's the best way to describe it? The insurance companies contract adjusters like me out, go inspect this house that got damaged, and write your report about how much money it should cost to repair it.
I get it. Now, by the way, though, that it might be kind of delicate. I mean, I would imagine an adjuster gets a reputation with the company as, you know, a guy who's either, okay, this guy's going to really look out for our interests. This guy's a sucker for the client, or, you know, who knows what, right? Or do they, or
right.
is that part of the, does that come up?
Yeah, it's, and you know, the way I see it is, if I don't write up for anything that I don't have a picture of, and that's really what a good adjuster can do to protect everyone involved, is this is why I'm replacing, you know, this is why I'm adding 15 grand to replace the floors is because of this picture right here. So that way it's not James is saying, it's, you know, James got the picture and that's irrefutable.
Now it's a bit of an art. I mean, I would imagine if you sent randomly, like three different adjusters to look at the same damage, they could come up with very different assessments.
It is. Yeah, it absolutely is. There's really no, I mean, there should be a science to it, but it's just not how it's constructed to be. But, you know, the bottom line is making sure that everyone knows, you know, when I go into every single inspection, I want to find all the damage I possibly can that's related to that claim. And, you know, there's actually some EOD equity there because you're trying to figure out how something came from together. And the investigation is also the same that I applied to looking for booby traps in a house. You know what I mean? It's one way to make sure you don't miss anything.
How long does it take to get become one of those?
Now, that is the problem with the industry. So it's like a 40-hour course online, ominous, dominus, you're an insurance adjuster. And it's, in my opinion, the industry, it's almost criminal in the industry because they shouldn't allow guys like me when I first started and got my license in 2016. I didn't know how to build a house. I didn't know what fascia was. I didn't know what soffit is. And the guys that would make the best insurance adjusters are like former general contractors. Those guys are worth their weight in gold. And it's a disservice to the homeowner if you don't have that expertise. Like I did not have that when I first started.
How did you get
really just on the job training or on the job training and constantly researching. You know, whenever I come across a general contractor, I'm always asking questions. Still to this day, I am, you know, how the house is constructed like that, what it takes, you know, that type of thing.
Gotcha. How old are your kids now?
They are Lawless is 4 and Felix is 2.
And what do you like to do that has nothing to do with insurance or water or anything family related, like your own personal hobbies?
My own is taking the kids out. We have a shared little, it's a boat, but it's not, don't get really nice boats in your head. It's a tri-hole pleasure craft that's, you know, we kind of just beat up. But I like taking that out. I'm learning how to kite surf now. When I have the time, I'll be able to get my second lesson in. But any time to be out on the water with the boys and Katie is my happy place.
I love it, man. Sounds like you got it all going on. Would you ever run for office again?
No. No. And Katie asked me that question too. And no, I just can't see it. I just like tangible work too much. And you know what's interesting is I think if I had won back then in 2016, it's hard to wrap my brain around, but I could have been so... I keep wondering, I'm like, could I have been wrapped up in the very problem that I was trying to fix? Like the rhinos, obviously I have a problem with the Democrats, but that's a political issue. But could I have gotten swept up in the Adam Kinzingers and Liz Cheney's of the world? And I think it's, you know, mostly no back then. But even if I won, if I ran again now, it'd be like a hard no. I'd never get mixed up in that group, which is interesting for me to think about because, our current state of affairs in the country, I think people are waking up to it, and we just need more of the people that use the phrase the republic instead of a democracy.
I understand. And look, I have one other thing, and we can end it here, but it did occur to me, across my mind, when you're talking about... I mean, you talk about people waking up, and I don't know if this is crazy or what, but, you know, there's all sorts of murmurings about children being abused for, you know, in the worst possible way, and ties to powerful people in government. Do you think there's anything to that?
I think the old adage, the founders were right, absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think where there is no oversight, things like that happen. Evil, you know, prevails. But, you know, one of the things, I think the last thing I would like to leave you and the audience with is, like, you know how you beat that? You know how you prevent that from happening? You have, there's more good people than bad people. And it's the Edmund Burke quote. We all know it, I hope, by heart at this point. But the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. So, you know, if anyone out there is thinking to themselves, man, I'd like to get involved, or I'd like to do this, I'd like, you know, I'm tired of what I see in the world when I look out, my answer to that, my response would be, just go do something. Just wake up and fall into something. You know, go work at a soup kitchen. Go, you know, finally sign up for this group like Aerial Recovery, you know, that is doing something that you truly align with from a moral standpoint. Or it doesn't have to be crazy, but just start the process of making an impact in the world. So that way, if we start a revolution strong enough and wide enough and almost like a brush fire, then that darkness that you're talking about, that I think definitely exists at the top, it loses its power. And then we can actually, you know, make a difference at the grassroots level.
Well, quite a guy, right? Going up to bombs and cutting wires. And I mean, damn, that's just pretty much as heroic as it gets. And then as a side hustle, he's rescuing children from war zones. I mean, wow, that's, and what an amazing outfit that is, the Aerial Recovery Group. Now, they've set up something where you can donate to help these orphans. Ukraine Orphan Rescue, here's what you do. Go to aerialglobalcommunity.org. Aerialcommunity.org. Aerial, A-E, excuse me, A-E-R-I-A-L, globalcommunity.org. Aerial, A-E-R-I-A-L. Aerialglobalcommunity.org. 100% of your donations will go to supporting the refugees. Thank you so much to them, to James Zumwalt, and to his cousin, Maya Zumwalt, and to be continued, everybody. Many, many thanks.